please give a warm welcome to our speaker tonight, Lisa S. from the Chesapeake Big Book Cumber.
Thank you so much. My name is Lisa. I am an alcoholic.
Lisa.
I have a sober date, January 28th of 2007. I have a home group. It's a Big Book study, as you know. I think I might be the last speaker this month from our group. And normally we would support our other home group members, but I think we had season passes to ODU, so I'm sorry this is my first appearance this month. we're not a glum lot, and we have a lot of fun, and that's been my experience maybe not day one, but I have an amazing life today that I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to try to briefly tell you without too many details about what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. I will tell you, I do have a sponsor. I had an original sponsor that took me through the 12 steps, page by page, in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't connect the dots right away, but I did get it enough to stay, and I'll share that about myself and my story. I have a sponsor today. It's not the same one that took me through the steps. And I do call her frequently. She is a sponsor, and I have the privilege, and I have a great fear. I think my most fear, the fear that I have today, is that, and it's been in the past too, that I won't have someone to work with, because that's how I get better. I have to intensely work with another person to be okay on a regular basis. That's just my experience. And that's been a fear. I don't know, I need to do more fear inventory, I guess, but I'm gonna keep staying here so that might not happen. But anyway, as long as I'm here and I'm vertical, which I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just remember feeling really weird when I was really young. We moved from New York City, Greenwich Village, when I was really young, and I remember feeling that there was like an underlying morose or sadness in the household. It was my mom and my dad and me, and my mom was pregnant with my little brother. It's like nobody was really happy to be there. We moved to help my mother's, my grandparents, who were both sick at the same time. I was sick, I had a chest cold, I think my dad was yelling or something, and my mom took me upstairs and poured something in a cup and gave it to me. And when I drank it, I forgot all about my chest cold and my sticky nose. And it's like I walked around with this cloud I didn't know I had, and it went away. And I wanted more, and I asked my mom if I could have more, and she looked troubled and said no. And then I was sneaky right from the start. I waited till her hands were like in the sink doing dishes. My dad had an ice pack on his head. I don't know why I remember that. He has his own story though. And I went back and stood on the commode and tried to find it in the medicine cabinet, and it was empty. It was just space. And I remember being disappointed. I think I was 4, you know, and I remember that today. I was just a quirky kid. I don't know, I was always trying to fit in. I had a friend that, through church, I grew up in an Episcopal church, and I wanted to fit in. She was in the choir, and her whole family of sisters sang and played guitar, and I couldn't sing, but I mouthed the words so I would fit in church. And I said, well, why don't we follow the big choir people to take communion so that we can get some of the wine, you know? And so I was doing stuff like that from an early age, like in the children's choir. And we got away with it once, so we just kept doing it, you know, until being confirmed was no big deal. We had already been doing that the whole time. I don't really remember my first drink. I remember being young at a big party in Richmond, and a lot of people were older than me. I was in a sorority. I don't know what, why I was in a sorority at 14, but it was in school. And I went to a Halloween party. I dressed as a punk rocker. I still have a ripped ear from sticking a safety pin, you know, through the hole. But I remember David Bowie, Fame, was playing, and people were bobbing for apples, and I drank beer, and people thought it was funny, and it was on. I was like, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. So I chased that. Every weekend, I was drinking four nights a week in high school. I remember I had a girl in French class come up to me, my friend Ken Burr. She said, Lisa, do you realize you drink four nights a week and you're in high school? And I'm like, yeah, but you're square. You know, that's what the word was then. You're square. Drinking age was 18, so I mean, I would skip school and we would just go, and I don't know why we were served beer in the morning, but we were. And I barely got out of high school. I was the second to the last graduating person because my dad spoke to the government teacher and did something, and then I got to graduate. But every weekend it was, you know, I would get the spins from drinking, but then I could keep a little more down the next weekend, you know, or at the keg party. The grain party, it was always grain alcohol, or and I was the one, when I got my license, I would be take everybody home with my right eye shut so that the lines would come together. I come home with grass under the license plate, you know? I mean, I got home and got those people home. I still, that blows my mind today. Somebody was looking out for me and those gals. Anyway, I didn't know where I was going. I was lost. I went to community college. I didn't even go to class. I would just smoke and party all the time, and just hang out in the common area. You could smoke then in the common area. And then I finally got tired of drinking. By the time I was 21, I said, I'm not doing this. I was just tired of it. So by the time I was 21, I quit for 1 year, which made me for a long time keep drinking, therefore non-alcoholic, because it was just like the paragraph in the big book where it says that some of us were able to stop for a period of time, and that was me for a year, a whole year. But then what happened, I've got to speed this up. I was to now go through things. I didn't share about this. I have the same story. It doesn't change much about what, you know, what it was like and what happened. I had a girlfriend where we were sitting at a club at Rockets, and the Chili Peppers were getting ready to go on, and she had a half a Heineken. And I'd already gone to the bar three or four times, and I said, Ashley, do you want another beer? And she said, no. I said, is that your first beer? She said, yeah. I'm like, what is wrong with you? You know, I thought everybody drank like me too. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that was a little bit before that. So I stopped drinking for a year, and I started doing Tai Chi with my mom and drinking carrot juice and going to the Grace Place in Richmond. And I don't know, I think I did aerobics. My father got sober in AA, but got sober through the 24-hour-a-day book, and that's his story. So he got really well and became East Coast racquetball champion, and then became a marathon runner, and would go to Boston and run all these marathons in the 70s when the running boom, and I would just travel along with him. And I noticed that when I played sports or I did sports, I felt better. It was like I always had to have something to make me feel better. The endorphins helped me temporarily. I was always searching for something to fill a void. And it talks about that we have a spiritual malady here, alcoholics do, and I can really relate to that. Definitely had a spiritual malady. I was to Polar Geographical Cure to Virginia Beach in 1987, and then I never went back. And then I couldn't differentiate between being at the beach and drinking every day, because it was a party. Every day was a party. I lived off a Shore Drive. And so, and then I got my first DUI, and I told the policeman that not only had I been drinking, but I've drank more than I ever have drank before in my life when I got pulled over, because it was just so bad, you know. I said, this is more than the kamikaze parties, you know. It's bad. And so he let me sit in the office instead of the jail cell, you know. I think he felt sorry for me. And anyway, I just remember a friend trying to help me drive home where they drove, and I did the clutch, and I was doing the stick shift. That's all I remember. And when I got home, I looked in the refrigerator, and I'm like, my roommate's got champagne. Let's just open this, you know. And I remember drinking all of her whatever was left. And I was bad off, you know. I don't know what I would have blown, because they didn't, I don't think they did that. But it, anyway, I was to, okay, so I did that. And so in my lifetime, what would happen is I would get my stuff together a little bit and go back to school. And I changed my major from admin, business administration, to liberal arts. And then when something got too hard, I'd switch it back to something else. And I was doing that. I was lifeguarding at a pool and waitressing at night. And the lifestyle of the beach, you know, we'd draw straws and we'd all end up at Chicho's. And I was probably too old to go to Chicho's then, you know. But I've just lived this life. You know, I rode my beach cruiser to work, you know. And I did get fired for drinking. I passed out. I had a whole room full of Shriners, and I was drinking with them, and then drinking all the extras, you know. And I just blacked out and ended up getting fired from my job. But I gotta keep going here. So again, I had periods where I would say, enough of this. I'm not doing this. It's the people I'm hanging out with. They're like the, you know, the problem. I need to just drink carrot juice. I need to get myself together. And so I would run on the boardwalk after work. Then I trained for a marathon. And then the Tidewater Strider race coordinator saw my marathon time and asked me to be on the marathon team. And then at the same time, I passed my insurance license and I got a job where I was making a lot more money than I was bartending or waitressing. And it's like I had arrived. I was training, but you know, it was so cool. And the insurance industry, I end up after the seminars at the bar, you know, and met all my peeps, you know, mostly the crazy people from the West Coast, you know. And then the same way with the running, I always hooked up with people. My mentor, she drank a lot. Well, she drank wine. But none of those people are AA. I'm the only one that made it here. But so they might just be heavy drinkers, you know. They still have jobs. They still retired, you know. They still were able, I don't think their lives were unmanageable, you know. Anyway, where was I? So I had arrived, and I drank. I remember going to jail for DUI. And the next weekend, I'm running a 5K trying to help this little girl run. And I'm like, girl, you were in jail last weekend, you know, trying to, and it's like, something's wrong with this. You know, I just had a lot of guilt and shame. And then I was the one that would run these races. I placed in the top five in Richmond. And, you know, and then I just drank right away. Oh my God, I would just drink. And then get it together. And just like the guy, Jim, that put whiskey in his milk, you know, he showed up on Tuesday for an automobile place that he used to own, you know, that was me. I was at work on Tuesday. Where were you on Monday, you know? Monday, I wasn't able to be there because I, you know, drank too much Sunday. I would have so many bad. I wasn't like Dr. Bob. I had terrible, terrible hangovers. My hangovers were so bad. I thought I would die of hangovers, you know, having a hangover. I remember, I did hear the dog sometimes, but I was a binge drinker. So I would like get it together a little bit. I was the one in the doctor's opinion, the psychopath that makes many resolutions and never a decision, always going on the wagon for keeps. Making many resolutions but never a decision, that was me. I was like, I'm never going to do that again. And then I'd have some friends tell me, Lisa, maybe you just process alcohol different from us, you know? And I don't know, I just ignored it, I guess. So the last part of my drinking, it was really like someone was throwing a grounder. In baseball, like, I was hitting the ground. I ended up getting injured. I could no longer be on that marathon team, and it was pour me another drink instead of showing up and volunteering with others to help people. So now I'm at home, pour me. And then I noticed that a lot of other friends that got sick or were injured, they would still show up and support their peers, you know? Then I started going to the bar in the neighborhood at Munden Point, way out in the middle of nowhere, that I said, I'm never going there. So then I go there, and then I hung out with people that just got out of rehab that didn't want to be in rehab. And then I ended up going to other places. And then due to my alcoholic mind and my alcoholic thinking, I made choices that were not conducive to marriage. And I ended up giving away a 14-year marriage. And then I really went down a spiral after that. Moved to the West Coast twice because the first time it didn't work out, I had to take a U-Haul again. And this is the last, I say throwing a grounder. I never had kids, but I had this thing happen where, you know, something like that happened, but it didn't happen. And I it was those people from California that I met at work, you know, that now I was single. I was out there in Oregon. I moved to Oregon. But I was with people that did the same thing I did. Or just a little worse, so that I didn't look so bad. Like, I wasn't jumping through plate glass windows or taking van doors off, standing there. You know, I had it a little bit more together. I don't know if I said therefore non-alcoholic, but I did use the fact that I was a marathon runner for so many years that I was not an alcoholic, because alcoholics can't do that. They can't run a 6:55 pace. They can't hold that together. I'm not the person under the bridge. And one debacle I had, I called some place for help because I made an embarrassment out of myself, and I just did it to show face or whatever you call it. And I remember the guy, I don't even remember what question he asked me, but he said, and whatever I said to him, I don't even know. But I remember him saying, you're the same person as a man under the bridge. Got me back. And I still don't know the whole conversation, but I remember that. Anyway, I ended up, it didn't work out there. And I don't know how to talk about it. It's just, I came back with everything I owned in my car and involving my dad as a 42-year-old woman. And made it almost to across the country without drinking until Hot Springs, Arkansas. And when I drank that drink, it made all the pain go away of every bad decision I've ever made in my whole life. Only I needed more, you know. So I ended up having to stay there a couple of days because I drank so much, couldn't get in the car. And then that grounder was hitting. And then right before that, sorry, I left this out. So this is really cool. We went to Red Rock Canyon, stopped in Vegas. So we went from Oregon to pick up my dad, Sacramento, went to Vegas. His best friend from high school was a lawyer in the old section of Fremont Street in Vegas. Okay? So he likes to hike. So So we're hiking Red Rock Canyon, like a little 3 mile hike. And Andy is looking at my dad and he's saying, Bill, why didn't you tell me about AA? That got my attention. And my dad said, mumbled something. I don't even know what my dad said. But I heard what Andy said. So later on, we go, before getting on the road again, we go to Benyon's at a cheesy buffet, and we're sitting there, and Andy, who was so sweet to me before, takes his fist out and pounds it on the table like a picnic table, and my food came up off my plate, and he pointed at me and he said, you need to take a spiritual pill, 90 and 90. And I was pissed. I'm like, I don't have a pill problem, you know? But I didn't say that, I just thought it. And what happened was, I was to hit that grounder after Hot Springs, Arkansas, and then I had a home that I've managed to hang on to, but eight people were living in it and I didn't have a place to live. And so I was living between the Days Inn, because I had a dog, and I had enough money from the insurance money from my monthly that I was still able to get a little bit of it, and I had some money left over that I secured an apartment. And I went to the bar, and well, not the bar, I'm sorry, I went to 7-Eleven and got wine, because now I was going to 7-Eleven instead of Total Wine to get wine. And then I drank that, but I needed more and ran out, and I went down to Timbuktu, the bar, and the Jamaican chef there, he like looked like the Grim Reaper. He pointed, he goes, the locals go across the street, like that. That was my last night of drinking, and you couldn't make it up. Like, you could write, it's like a bad book, but it happened, you know? And I went over there, and that bartender, she was so amazing. She poured wine all the way to the top of the glass, and no one ever did that for me. You know, I got cut off at wine tastings. I don't talk about that. You know, the embarrassment, like, can't she just pour a little more? That is so embarrassing. They look at you with a disturbed look, and no, you know, like, ignore you, like you don't exist. I drank so much. I drank myself sober. Eyes wide open, sober. It didn't work. My mind was still going speed brain. And I looked around and I'm like, somebody's got to have something. And this guy, he looked like, I don't know, like Willie Nelson today. And he had four roaches. And I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but this is my story. I just took them all and smoked them all because I was in that much pain. And I had drank a lot. And I had 2 days before ended up on a helicopter pad doing 120, like with somebody, a stranger car with my dog in the car, thinking I was gonna take off like an airplane or something. You know, I mean, this is where my alcoholism gets me. I am not an at-home drinker. I am at large. That's what my friend Jennifer says. Lisa, we're at large. You know? So what happened is I went to the hotel room and I'm laying there and my feet were getting cold and my legs were getting cold and my way, everything was getting cold and I'm like, oh my God, I think I'm dying. And I thought about my mom and then I thought, not like this. And I hit the phone and hit zero. Came to with an oxygen mask on my face and Virginia Beach General the next day. I thought about Andy saying, you need to take a spiritual pill, 90 and 90. When my eyes popped open, I saw in my mind's eye, game over on the wall, like, you know, I'm looking at a wall, but it may as well have said game over in like neon lights. And I thought, I don't know why I don't like Gone with the Wind. I thought about Scarlett O'Hara at the foot of the stairwell and all the rubble saying, I can go back to Tara. And I said, I can go back to AA. Those people can help me. It's free. I don't have to use an insurance card. And I walked out with sock feet. They told me that I had to call someone. I was so sick, I went back and laid down and they had to kick me out of the hospital. They said, you gotta call someone. I called my dad. He comes and he's standing in the hall and I see him shaking his head like this. No more 911. You know? I didn't realize I had done so much for so many years. you know, from him picking me up in jail and rolling the window down, or not rolling it down, you know, hitting the window because I smelled so bad. You know, it's like just everything. Getting news that I'm in jail in Redding, California, you know, drunk in public. But the person stole my necklaces, and I'm so crazy, I chased them down. But they call the police on me, right? Mm-hmm. But then the bounty hunter takes me, and they give the guy a ride home, you know? That's when, and I still didn't know what I was until I came to in that hospital, and then I realized, I think I did 1, 2, and 3, because it's like I had a lobotomy. I could not will alcohol in my brain. It was gone. It had disappeared. It's almost like Godsmack, you know? It's like, enough, child. Enough. You know? You're done. I said I was cold. It was January. I walked out in sock feet and shoes, and I went to the psych center, had a meeting that met from the outside. You didn't have to go in the psych center to get there, it was the outside. When I walked in, there was a guy in front of me, it was standing room only. I literally felt like we were climbing over chairs. It was that packed. But he said, "God help me." And I said, "God's gonna help both of us." And you know, there were 7 people that picked up white chips, and they were all out when I got up there. And this person felt so sorry for me. They were like, "Here, you can take mine." And that was my only white chip. So I didn't have a smartphone or phone then. It was like a Nokia or whatever. I don't know. We had meeting lists. It was like, okay, I'm going to do 90-90. I'm going to take that spiritual pill. And I went every day, and it was like a game to me. I circled the meeting directory, and I had where I was going to go every day. And I did go to a lot of the beach. I was living at 57 and a half street. But this is what's so cool. I went to some meetings. Every meeting I heard something that I loved because I needed to get it. I didn't look at anybody for what they looked like, what they said. I didn't give a rat's patootie. I needed to get sober. And I didn't care. But the thing is, there were candlelight meetings, and there were cowboy hats at some meetings and things like that. And I'm like, this is like a tail end of a cocktail party. I do not need to be here. So my home group I chose was There's a Solution. Graham and my original sponsor, Jeanette S., started it with 2 others. And it was a big book study and a speaker meeting. Monday night speaker meeting so you could identify. And then the Thursday night book study. I don't know, I was so sick that I volunteered to help someone else make the coffee, okay? I couldn't commit, I could commit, but I didn't have confidence. I still struggle with that. But what happened was, it was so slow for me because I wanted it so bad. I wanted it quick. It's like, where are these steps in this holy grail of a book, you know? And my sponsor said, "Lisa, ag means without and Gnostic means knowledge. We without knowledge." And that hit me like a ton of lead. Like, you're right. I don't know. And it's okay. I'm going to drop all my old ideas about God. I'm going to pick up new ideas about God. And then I'm going to make a decision about God for myself. How freeing is that? That was just as freeing as what Abby told Bill. It went from, "Bill, why don't you choose your own conception of God?" I think I just dropped the ceremony, you know? The Episcopal, I just dropped everything I thought I knew. That I believed in God, that he was in Japan somewhere. Or I don't know. And he didn't like to have the kind of fun I like to have. So, you know, I was full of guilt and shame. But she opened my eyes. I was willing to go, "Lisa, you don't know. You don't know nothing. You don't. You've done a lot. You've run marathons. You could try to teach someone how to do something. You've sold some insurance, but you know nothing." And I don't know. I was really sick. My sponsor took me page by page. We went twice a week through the book. I thought it was once a week, but she reminded me it was twice a week. Pockets of Enthusiasm was a really big deal then, and Clancy came in, and I was just miserable, you know, my first night, no sleep for a year. I was one of those people. And always, like, something going on, and somebody trying to say, Lisa, there's nothing bad happening right now, okay? Mm-hmm. But I'm okay, you know, it's okay now. But then it was not okay, but I showed up at my home group no matter what. I was there early, you know, with a frown, crying every day, crying. And but I was there. That was a miracle. I showed up for the same place twice a week for 9 years. What the heck? And then but when I got Lyme disease and things didn't happen so great in sobriety, my mom died suddenly. At a year and 10 months sober, and then dad got cancer, and then my dog died that went with me cross country everywhere, and then I got bit by a tick, and I'm like, man, this is bad. I feel like Job in the Bible. I think I started reading that. But I showed up for my home group. I didn't stop doing Alcoholics Anonymous. I showed up at intergroup. I met Scott at intergroup. I was there all sad. Everyone thought I was a newcomer, I think, because he said that, because I was just so sad. And then I thought, you know, I prayed that. I said, God, I said, man, I'm coming into my home group, and I don't think anybody wants what I have. So I'm like, ready to be with you or whatever. But that's when they didn't find out what it was, and it was lying, and I got treated, and I'm better. I'm not great, but I got better, you know. And it was through helping someone in Alcoholics Anonymous that their doctor found it, you know. It was really cool. I don't know what to say about this. I just want to say that... This stuff is real. It's like there's no door number three at all for me. I had a conversation with someone last night, and they said, oh yeah, I'm only going to go to half the meeting. I was at a meeting that meets an hour and a half last night. They take a break, and they were like, oh, I just came by, and I think I'm going to go to the gym or go do something or whatever. And I'm like, well, I'm glad you can do that, but I can't do that. I haven't done it yet. I mean, I know I could do anything tomorrow, but I take this serious. This is like, I'm either going to blot out my existence to the bitter end or accept spiritual help. If there's no door number three, I'm either making every decision today to take me closer to God or further away. And that's my reality. I am serious about this. Maybe two people throw Rule 62 at me, and it gets me really mad. I mean, I'm better at it now. But I had a woman hand me two medallions. She said, which one do you want? They both said Rule 62 on it. It was Nina. Sorry, Nina. But anyway, I'm going to owe you in a minute. But I don't know. I mean, okay, real quick, I saved seats early on. My sponsor said, Lisa, you're not sleeping anyway. You may as well go over and save us seats for Clancy or for, you know, Sandy Beach. I've got to see Don M., you know, who said, folks, I don't care if you're in the middle of robbing a bank. There's a next right thing to do. And that spoke to me. So many times I've done something. I'm going down that road, you know, and I know I don't need to go down that road. I need to turn around and go back. And that was so awesome. He spoke to me. I had people early on give me CDs. Jim S. gave me Chuck Chamberlain's new pair of glasses. I had Don M., I had Father Tom, and I had Bob D., all loaded weapons in my car, and that's all I did. I didn't listen to the radio, I just listened to them. And they became, it's like, everything that Chuck said, it was like, I get that. Your business is your business until it becomes my business. I can go for that. Mm-hmm. You know, I started all over in Alcoholics Anonymous. I made $12.50 an hour in 1987 at the bank. And when I pulled my geographical cure and I came here, I could not sell life insurance. I could not work right. I could not go back to the company where people, places, and things. And I left. I did the hardest thing. I left. And then I ended up getting sick, and I couldn't do that. I said, Lacey, you're going to lose your house if you don't go do something. And I ended up making $10.50 an hour, $2 less in 2010 than in 1987. So AA, when I read that story in the back of the big book somewhere where it says AA has taught me to work from the bottom up, I'm like, yeah, it really has. Literally, it really has. So it took me from the bottom up. I'm doing that. I'm with three women that don't like me. I'm used to 1099, throwing my map in my car. You know, that was when you had maps. And driving. Perfect job for an alcoholic. Edenton to Fredericksburg, you know? Solo. And now I'm working with three women, and because they don't like me because I ask the same questions over. I need to get a notebook and write it down. I need to get there better, you know, early. I need to do certain things. And I learned that through the traditions and through Alcoholics Anonymous taught me, even if I don't like you, I love you, you know, just to get along. And who cares if I'm faking it till I make it? I've been doing that the whole time. If I'm honest, I have been faking it until I make it. And sometimes it's not pretty, you know? And I tend to attract the people that may have had something in their background where they have an outside illness or something happened to them, where they have an enduring sadness, but they're coming to AA and they're doing it despite what has happened to them. I told my sponsor, I'm not going to the one meeting because I'm too sick to go and work full-time and do this. And then I go to this meeting on Sunday, take the lady in the wheelchair to the women's meeting. I wanted to surf instead, stay there. I go and take her. I'm there. This girl comes up to me and says, will you help me? I said, well, yeah, I'll meet you at my home group. I kind of got an outside issue. I did say this, not from Lyme, but I'll meet. And she goes, I have Lyme disease. And she had a bracelet on her arm that she just got out of the hospital for alcohol poisoning. You know what I mean? So you can't make this stuff up. So I met her there. I don't sponsor her today, but we went through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous together. We did it at Zeke's Beans and Bowls, believe it or not, right by my home group was at Mediterranean, right down the beach across from the Junior Market. And we just did it, you know, and then she helped someone who's still sober today. So, I don't know. I just know that real quick through service work, I was GSR, only alternate. My mom died suddenly. It was my first assembly was when the GSR had a baby. His wife had a baby. And so I was like, well, you're up, you know? And so I went, and it was amazing. It was like New York City. 400 and some people. It was so cool, you know? Oh, my God, there's a guy talking about anonymity in the digital age, and he had dark glasses on. He was a delegate. And he said, you got to be careful. I'm still wanted in South America. And I'm like, that is so cool, you know? I mean, there are so many cool stuff, you know, I love alcoholics. I was somewhere where there was a mouse, and then there was a roach by the mouse, and somebody got very upset and ran and screamed and said something about the meeting and ran out. But you know, they did. They came back and made amends to the whole group. Lately, it's been really weird. I love AA. You never know what's gonna happen, man. That's all you gotta just. And the beautiful gift, I'm all over the place, but the best gift of all is to be present. And I don't have kids, but my niece and nephew come and see Scott, and I, Miles is a handful. And anyway, you know, I'm there. I'm not anywhere else. My voicemail is never full. I'm not allowed to do that for my first sponsor. She's still in my head. I can't do much, you know? It's like, she was the one that, you know, and when I was complaining, she sent me the email before the graphics were really good that said, pour me another drink. And she told me something else too. She said, in the inventory, your assets did not get you here. We didn't talk about that. It seems punishing, you know, but to teach is discipline. And I'm good with that. I want to hear the truth. I had, you know, I had enough of the other stuff, or conning myself, really. I don't know, I guess, do I have 1 minute or something? Or, and I have this one. Oh, okay. So service, real quick, I'll talk about that really quick. Service, I happened to be, then I was the GSR, But before that, I was a secretary for my home group. I could not read my notes. Everyone was frustrated, but they still loved me. But they were frustrated, you know, because they had to do a good job. Why can't I, you know? Couldn't read my notes. Everybody was in service with the home group I originally went to. People were going to the jails. People were going to the detoxes. People were involved in public information and CPC. I had a really amazing home group. So that's where I come from. I don't know anything different. And I'm grateful for that. I can't believe how I fell into it. Scott encouraged me because I had to be pushed. I was going through some stuff with Lyme and I didn't want to, and there was a girl that I knew. We came in together. People had bets that we wouldn't make it. I found out later, but she ended up being treatment chair, and she needed help, but there wasn't anybody really showing up, and so I went, and I started doing it, and then there were two other guys there, but each one of something happened to them, and then Jennifer W. became the president for Intergroup and asked me if I would be treatment chair, and I was like, wow, and so I'm like, I don't know what to do, so I just read the manual. I read it like 5 times because I was like, how can I do this? We go to Oxford Houses. We play the movie Hope. We go everywhere. Oh my God, how am I going to do this? 24 people in my living room. Scott's. 24 people showed up to help me. It's like if you build it, they will come. I built it because I read the darn book is all I did. And then I got information. And then if you learn something, be careful, because then it's asked of you. And so then after that, I was kind of sad about leaving. And Steve R. called and said, it's not good that you just do that and then you don't do anything. So you might want to be on the steering committee. But then they tricked me because it was COVID and the next year went by. And then we finally were in an intergroup and it was October and the nominating committee chair came up to me and said, would you stand for president? And I'm like, what? President? I mean, you know? And I said, no, I need to pray and meditate on that. And they said, no, you don't really do that the next day. But anyway, it's a joke. I hate chairing at my own group. I chaired it for 2 years and people put up with me for 2 years. Now Pete W. does it and they tell me they get out like 30 minutes early or 20 minutes early. But I did the best I could. I read Robert's Rules. I had my book. I had the, you know, I used to be afraid of the bylaws. Now I was read them every night before going up there. You know what I mean? Like I went from intergroup rep to I don't even want to go there. You know, I don't want to read bylaws. Now I get it. It's like I get it. It's so cool. And then I can take that out. One time I went to public information, you know, at a school, they were going over some road issues and new bike paths and things like that. And then you're taking it to the streets, you know, or getting knowledge about what's going on in the community. But anyway, okay, I'm like full of it, but I think I'm done. But I still do service. I go to the jail. I met a gal and I'm grateful for that, and sorry. So I'm doing that, and I'm sponsoring women. And I was in a really crappy mood, and somebody called crying, and I was able to snap out of everything. That's what AA does for me. I snap out of it when it doesn't matter what's happening if somebody needs help. So anyway, it really works. And that's the shortest paragraph in the big book. It works, it really does. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you for sharing.